Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Professional Responsibilities Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 15, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Today, we welcome three experts to our call. They include Professor William Hodes. He's Professor Emeritus of Law at Indiana University, and he is President of the William Hodes Professional Corporation. Also, Professor Thomas D. Morgan. He's the Oppenheim Professor Emeritus of Antitrust and Trade Regulation Law at the George Washington University Law School. And we'll be joined by Professor Ron Rotunda, Doy and D. Henley Chair and Distinguished Professor of Jurisprudence at Chapman University, Dale E. Fowler School of Law. Professor Morgan is going to get us started today, and again, at approximately 2:46, we'll open the floor to your questions. Thank you for joining us. Professor Morgan, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. This program on legal ethics has become an annual member service for the Federal Society, and the three of us on the call today try to help you meet a CLE requirement of most states. We'll be dealing with recent developments in the legal ethics field that we hope will be of interest to you in their own right, but also because of some broader issues they raise about the rule of law and the role of lawyers in our society. It seems traditional to lead off ethics CLE programs with changes to the model rules, and today we're going to have Ron Rotunda start us off with probably the most significant model rules change in over a decade. It's the addition of new model rule 8.4G, that's G as in George, that prohibits harassment and discrimination by lawyers. It was a noble sounding purpose, and I think many people thought it would be easy to draft a rule. But the topic proved to be much more complex than it may have seemed. You're likely to see this ABA model come up for consideration in your own state. So, Ron, tell us about 8.4G and why it's proved so controversial.
The 8.4G is in your materials, and it's deceptively clear. It's definitely not nearly as broad as one would think when reading it. It says if a lawyer engages in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination, and then there's a litany of things, some of which are illegal and some of which are not, that is race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status, and is in conduct related to the practice of law. But then you go to the comments, and the first thing they tell us is that that conduct includes verbal conduct. There's apparently verbal or physical conduct. It manifests bias or prejudice towards others, like a derogatory word, unwelcome request for sexual favor, an unwelcome verbal or physical contact of a sexual nature. And the comments make clear that it does not matter whether this is illegal under state or federal law. He says you can look to state or federal law that that might guide application of the rule, but it doesn't control it. In fact, you could be sued for sexual harassment, win the case, and still be disciplined under this rule. The reporter's notes to the ABA House of Delegates says the reason we want this dramatic shift is there's a need. Why do we have this rule? There's a need for a cultural shift in understanding the inherent integrity of people based on, and then there's the usual litany. They want to create a cultural shift. And the ABA president said, we should do it because lawyers are responsible for making our societies better. And by our power, we are the standards. So, I mean, it's really a very grandiose theory about what we do. For example, under this rule, so let's just say one lawyer says to the other at the law firm, a water cooler or at a bar association meeting, I abhor the idle rich, we should raise capital gains. You can be disciplined for that, or you're subject to discipline. The other lawyer says, you're just saying that because you're a short, fat, hillbilly neo-Nazi. You're in the clear. The rule doesn't prohibit any of that. And we wonder, you know, lawyers should be fairly good in drafting rules about the governing of lawyers. And do they really mean that you cannot attack the idle rich probably not, but that's what they wrote. And then you look at what the EEOC says about what may be, for example, sexual or racial harassment. Not what the courts say. The EEOC sometimes loses in courts, but you still have to go through the hearings and work your way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. In a recent case, the EEOC said that it was a hostile work environment because the Postal Service allowed a worker to wear a cap that said, "Don't tread on me," with the drawing of a coiled snake. The EEOC said that they admitted "Don't tread on me" originated in the Revolutionary War, and it was considered a sign of believing in the New Republic and in non-racial conduct. But they said some people might think it's racist. One person said it was racist. I don't know why. He just said it was, and said the EEOC that is that's enough to have the full-blown hearing. This example. There's a bar meeting. There's proposals to curb police excessiveness. One lawyer says, either in the reception or in a panel discussion on it, says Black Lives Matter. Another responds, Blue Lives Matter, that is a police matter. We should be more concerned about black-on-black crime. And a third says, All Lives Matter. And finally, another lawyer, perhaps for comic relief, says, to make a proper martini, Olives Matter. Well, the first guy is in the clear. He said Black Lives Matter. All the other people can be subject to discipline if any person, whether or not a lawyer, hears this and says, we think that this is harassment for you. Now, in many cases, I don't expect the bar is going to try to discipline a lawyer, suspend a lawyer, even a public reprimand, because he says all lives matter. But there are ethics opinions, and the local bars, the ABA, the state bars, the county bars, they just issue their opinions about what you can do. And lawyers try to follow those so they don't get into trouble. And some of these groups are very active in what they do. Consider this, St. Thomas More Society meetings, an organization of Catholic lawyers, judges, and professors, and they're supposed to strengthen their faith through formal education, fellowship, and prayer. That's what they say on their webpage. Now, 8.4G says it covers law firm dinners, nominee social events, where there are lawyers because there are lawyers. At any of these events, let's say a St. Thomas More sponsored a CLE, some lawyers on a panel, maybe all the lawyers in the panel, discuss the gay marriage rulings and say they're against them, that marriage is God meant between a man and a wife. And another one will say maybe it isn't. The state bar can draft an ethics opinion advising lawyers they risk violating 8.4G if they belong to a law-related organization that's not inclusive. In fact, it supports a church that only has males as the ministers, and they will not marry a gay couple. Some lawyers may say it's better to be safe than sorry, and then just leave the St. Thomas More Society. For decades, lawyers, judges, and academics have been going to the St. Thomas More Purple Mass once a year. Recently in California, there was a secret judge's opinion. It is not published, but somebody in the judge's organization told the judges, you can't wear your robes at the Mass. The Mass is open to non-Catholics. Non-Catholics often come. There's a section for the judges. They're noted as judges, and now they come in their suits. There's no explanation about why this is so, but when I did a research on the web, I found plenty of other states where either there's an opinion that says you can wear your judicial robes at the St. Thomas More Mass, or you can they just saw photographs of people marching in the procession. You're not supposed to discriminate in speech based on marital status. Let's say the client walks into the lawyer's office, says, I'd like you to draft some palimony papers, and the lawyer says, I'm troubled by that. I don't believe in palimony. I think that it's wrong for you to take advantage of the woman, drop her when she becomes too old for your taste or you get tired of her, and drop her without any fear of financial consequences. You can go next door, the firm across the hall. They do the stuff, but I don't want to. You have a problem under this rule if under 8.4G, because maybe you're discriminated in your speech based on marital status. Now, there is a provision in the rule that says you can, this doesn't limit the ability of a lawyer to accept, decline, or withdraw from representation. However, the comments suggest that's because you're doing it to serve underserved people like minorities. In addition, you've got case law. Massachusetts, a few years ago, disciplined a lawyer, a law firm, because they would only handle women in divorces, not men. And so, again, you have an unnecessary, I think, problem raised for lawyers. Another way to think about this, the state bar has many things to do, and causing a cultural shift in the feelings of the world would not be higher on the list. Let's say somebody comes into the firm as a messenger, and you say, I'm not going to hire you. The other guy that came half an hour before you, he looks like a better messenger, more disheveled, and you didn't come even on time. And the messenger says, I'm going to sue you because you're discriminating against me because of my gender identity, my gender identification. What do you mean? I said, we don't know what you are. Yeah, but I notice you have male and female on your restrooms. You do not have them gender neutral. So I think that is harassment. And I'm going to sue you trying to derive a private right of action, cause of action, from the violation of the state rule. And a lot of courts do that. In fact, it's quite common to derive the causes of action from violations of the rule. And the law firm doesn't have gender-neutral bathrooms. And realize this rule applies even if your state has no law on gender identity, or in some cases, like North Carolina, says you have to go to public restrooms, you have to go to the restroom that is on the relates to the sex on your birth certificate. There's a host of problems going to be raised by this, and I don't know. I mean, it does solve another problem, that is underemployment of lawyers. We can make more money suing each other. Like everybody becoming richer by taking in everybody else's laundry, we can be richer as we sue each other on behalf of disgruntled messengers, suing law firms, have to hire other law firms to defend them in these suits. So it's going to be, I think, a mess because it's. Oh, and by the way, and one thing I think is a real hoot. What about if you seek to disqualify a juror? The other side says you did that because he's black. And the court agrees and refuses to accept the peremptory challenge. The rule says that alone doesn't violate this new rule. That is the one thing that is that a lawyer does while a lawyer that the trial judge has decided is racial discrimination and unconstitutional, that's no per se violation of this rule at all. So it's I think it's a hoot. Tom, I turn it over to you.
Thanks, Ron. I think everybody listening can tell, this is a topic that's going to be with us for some time. And as I say, it's going to have to be considered in each of the states. And as that consideration goes on, you may find yourself involved in that process. For our second topic, Bill Hodes is going to introduce us to some significant amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. You might ask what civil procedure rules have to do with legal ethics. But our answer is that these aren't just technical changes. They force us to think about the kinds of costs created by litigation and what it means to be a litigator and an officer of the court. Bill Hodes, the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom. You know, that last comment that Tom made about the relationship between rules of procedure and legal ethics reminded me that when I was teaching law from 79 to 99, those 20 years, I often noticed when I went to academic conferences that there was a greater overlap between teachers of civil procedure and professional responsibility, which were two of my main subjects. There's a greater overlap between those two than almost any other pair of courses you could name. And I think there is a reason for this. Unlike on TV and in the public consciousness, most lawyers don't litigate, and neither actually do most litigators. The litigators take discovery and they settle. Nevertheless, it's very, very useful in training new lawyers to use a fully played out courtroom drama to provide the framework for teaching law generally, because that's where we end up if other lawyering activities go well. Don't go well, you know that you may end up in court. This is what's going to look like. This is what you're going to try to avoid. But at the same time, when you're talking about full bore litigation, that really captures the central ethical dilemma of lawyering, I think, most pointedly, maybe most poignantly also. It's where zealousness, where adversarial zeal is at its maximum, and quite properly so. It's my ethical obligation to press for any advantage that I can get for my client, and any advantage I get, of course, has got to come out of the hide of the other guy. But ethical zealous advocacy must be contained within the bounds of law, and the rules of civil procedure are very definitely one important boundary line, so that doing the best you can, the most aggressive client-serving activity, but within the rule, within the framework that's set up by the by rules like the rules of civil procedure, really gives you that tension that's at the heart of much of lawyering. Now, as I noted in the materials, just the short summary of this this segment, the basic trade-off in discovery and how litigation works in the modern era, that trade-off was made in all the way back in 1938 when the rules were first adopted. Federal rules were first adopted and then copied in most states very quickly thereafter. As plaintiff's attorney, and by the way, that includes people who started out as defendants, they file a counterclaim, now they become plaintiffs and can get the benefit of these rules as well. As a plaintiff or a counterclaiming plaintiff, I can get the defendant into court, I can impose upon the defendant the cost of defense and the time and the resources and so on with only a very bare bones complaint, subject to little more than, lo and behold, an ethical requirement of good faith belief that this bare bones complaint that I filed was filed in good faith and that it is not privilege. And incidentally, but not coincidentally, that perception that you can file a very bare bones complaint, but it has to be in good faith and not frivolous, is also contained in Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That's Rule 11, as I'm sure most of you know. Now, in exchange for that bare bones pleading system, the system then contemplates robust, wide open discovery to supply the details and to avoid gotcha type surprises at trial. Again, the rules of procedure that are trying to put some kind of ethical boundaries on how the case actually proceeds. Yes, it's true that in discovery, a plaintiff can go rummaging around in a defendant's files, but it's also true that the defendant can find out damaging information about the plaintiff, can demand a physical exam, can learn who all the witnesses are going to be, and much, much more. And the theory in this trade-off is that by the time his discovery is over, if both sides know just about everything, it's easier to settle cases, and largely that has been borne out over the years. Now, because lawyers on both sides of a case have an ethical obligation to push as hard as they can to get as much as they can, as much information as they can. And if that makes life hard on the other guy and a little costly, well, I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it because I'm looking out for my guy, not the other guy. There have been constant complaints of discovery abuse from 1938 on down and today. And that's from both from the requesting side, requesting stuff that's, you know, crazy, overbroad, too detailed, going back too far, but also abuse from the responding side. You ask for all the documents that are relevant to such and such. I give you a warehouse full of documents, only three of which are probably relevant, and I paper you to death. So the rules have been tweaked and retweaked back and forth to adjust the benefits and burdens, particularly as regards the scope of discovery and with respect to the default rule of who has to show good cause to demand a little bit more discovery because there's such and such good cause, or is the default rule that the request is good unless the responding party makes a showing of good cause that it's gone a little bit too far. Now, to give just one example of how this ebb and flow works, take the very simple question of whether the defendant does or does not have liability insurance coverage. And if so, what are the policy limits? In the early days, some courts held that this information could not be discovered. Plaintiff cannot ask the defendant, how much of insurance do you have? Because, those courts said, it had nothing to do with the subject matter of the case. And that was the original scope of discovery. You can ask anything you want, it's not privileged, as long as it was within the, relevant to the subject matter of the case. And those courts said, well, insurance is not, it's relevant to something else, but it's not relevant to the subject matter of the case. No discovery. Other courts said, wait a minute, discovery is permissible because the subject matter of the case includes the possibility of settlement, and so, of course, that information is crucial to settlement. In 1970, this split of authority was resolved when Rule 26, the basic scope of discovery rule, was amended to permit this discovery explicitly. But that wasn't the end of it. Move ahead to 1993, information about liability insurance was not only discoverable, but it became part of the new required disclosures that were added to Rule 26A and had to be provided without a request even being made. So it went from possibly discoverable to definitely discoverable to you had to disclose it even without the other guy asking for it. And by the way, that last little bit about disclosing material without even being asked for it, that itself caused a big controversy in the world of legal ethics because some people said, no, my job is to help my client, not to help the other client. And so, again, it showed the tie-in between ethics and procedure. Now, after the 2000 amendments had narrowed the scope of discovery, I had earlier said it was anything goes as long as it's relevant to the subject matter. Now it was changed in 2000 to relevant to the claims and defenses of any party, not just the subject matter in general, but the specific claims and defenses that were in the case. Once that change was made, responding to some over-discovery in the ensuing years, more and more attention in the years since then has been paid to proportionality in general. That is, no over-discovery. If the case is only a $50,000 case, it doesn't make any sense to take $20,000 worth of discovery if the other guy has the stuff, but it would cost him, you know, 25 man hours to get it. Maybe you ought to find some other way to resolve this issue than asking him to expend all that time. So proportionality became a big issue, and in particular, proportionality with respect to ESI, electronically stored information, became a focus of concern. Now, the main point of the 2015 amendments, which went into effect on January 1 of this year, was to rearrange much of the material that had actually already been there bit by bit, 1983, 1993, 2000, and so on, and to highlight their relationship and priority. And I'll just give you sort of how it stands now. I put in the materials the main, most important parts of the rules. But the key is that it is still not necessary that the material sought will be admissible in evidence, but it must be relevant to any party's claim or defense, as I said, and it must be proportional to the needs of the case, taking into account several factors, the one I mentioned before, how much is at stake in the case, the burden of expense, and so on. The critical clarifying point in 2015 is that the disproportionate or overly burdensome analysis had to be done at the initial stage. In other words, if something is disproportionate or if it's overly burdensome, it's outside the scope of discovery right from the start. And so you have an obligation as a lawyer, an ethical lawyer, to say, I can't even ask this because I've already concluded that it's disproportionate. In the past, it was anything goes, but if it's disproportionate, that's a valid objection. Now the proportionality is built in to the analysis. Second point, the Bill, parties have an op.
We just need to move. We need to move it.
I think. I think that's it. The parties, as they have been in the past, are obligated to meet, to plan, to themselves talk through proportionality. Every request has to certify. If you want help from the court in a motion to compel, you have to certify. I've talked to the other side. I certify that it is proportionate. And so all of those are now front and center so that people can, yes, get the job done, but also do it in a way that doesn't disproportionately put burdens, unethical burdens, on the other side.
Thanks very much, Bill. And you've really shown us how both the procedural issues do become ethical issues. Some of us can remember the days when people used to say justice had no cost or no price that was too high. We're recognizing now that the resolution of disputes is a burden for not only the parties but for the society, and that cost issues are relevant. A third major development in the last year or so derives from a Supreme Court decision, North Carolina State Board of Dental Examiners against the FTC in middle of 2015. It's in the readings for this CLE, and it concerned the state action exemption to the antitrust laws. The state action exemption is premised on the idea that Congress adopted the antitrust laws in the context of substantial federal and state regulation. In cases where an agency like the SEC regulates a competitive industry, the courts ask whether Congress really gave the SEC the authority to regulate and effectively displace the antitrust laws. That's often hard to determine, even in the federal context. But it's even harder, obviously, where Congress clearly had no role in state regulatory decisions. In the case of state regulation, then, the Supreme Court might have invoked the Supremacy Clause to say that the antitrust laws always prevail. But that would have knocked out almost all state regulation, including, say, regulation of utility rates. Whether you think that's a good idea or not, the court did not believe Congress meant to wipe out all state regulation. So in those cases, the courts look for two things. First, do a state's constitution or laws, quote, clearly articulate, end quote, an intent that the state regulation replace competition as a method of determining output and rates for a given activity? And second, does the state provide, quote, active supervision, end quote, of the activity, such as through an independent regulatory agency? The North Carolina case involved a state board of dental examiners, a majority of whose members are practicing dentists. The board decided that teeth whitening services were part of the practice of dentistry, and thus only a fully licensed dentist could put your teeth in the gel that is supposed to make them bright and white again. The Supreme Court basically held that such regulatory decisions could not avoid antitrust liability when they are made by a board, a majority of whom stand to gain financially from the decision. Now, lawyers were quick to see that this decision could affect us as well. We have all kinds of boards and committees, ranging from local bar associations to the ABA itself, all of which, or many of which, draft ethical codes and opine on unauthorized practice issues that can benefit the legal profession. Litigation in several states with LegalZoom.com represents just one form of the attempt to regulate the production of standardized contracts that most of you are probably familiar with. And the prospect of treble damages for resisting those efforts tended to attract our profession's attention. Notice that the requirement of clear articulation of a desire to have regulation replace competition in a given field is really not an issue in lawyer situations. Nobody doubts that state Supreme Courts have state constitutional authority to regulate the practice of law, and that the state Supreme Courts have clearly indicated their intent to do so. Likewise, while almost all state judges are lawyers, in their role as judges, a few people would doubt, and the Supreme Court hasn't doubted, that they can exercise independent and active supervision of lawyers. So both rulemaking, that is ethical rulemaking, and bar discipline, because they're ultimately imposed by state Supreme Courts, those functions are almost certain to be held to be proper going forward. Then what activities might raise issues after North Carolina dentists? We don't know for sure, but almost any activities of voluntary associations like the ABA might do so. The ABA, for example, is simply a private club. It has no official status, and its rules and decrees are only influential. They're not binding on anybody. And state voluntary bar committees even are dominated by lawyers, but their decisions are not binding either. But recognizing the potential exposure that they might face and the damages that might go along with them, the Washington State Bar Ethics Committee this year suspended issuing ethics opinions until the possibility of antitrust liability was clarified. I suspect the Washington State Bar is more cautious than was necessary, But we can't say that for sure. And as I listened to Ron earlier in this program talking about opinions that might be seen as intimidating lawyer conduct, threatening lawyers with disciplinary action that might be reacted to by those lawyers with some kind of lawsuit, I had to realize that the exposure might indeed be there. Indeed, one group that doesn't seem to be getting the message is the ABA itself. Among the most anti-competitive restrictions lawyers face are Rule 5.4 that prohibits lawyers from forming partnerships with non-lawyers to deliver multidisciplinary services to clients, and Rule 5.5 that prohibits lawyers from helping non-lawyers deliver such services. No active supervision by state authorities limits what the ABA may proscribe in its model rules, and ABA efforts to assert influence over those subjects has been ubiquitous. But the question then becomes, are ABA efforts to influence official conduct that will receive antitrust immunity, are those efforts themselves subject to antitrust challenge? So far, the ABA has been held to not be liable for those efforts, but the future remains to be seen. The North Carolina dentist precedent should be welcome to anybody who would prefer to see competition rather than government regulation determine who whitens their teeth and who helps them write their contracts. It's an area of the law I urge you to watch over the next few years. And if North Carolina dentists moves lawyer regulation in a more competitive direction, we may indeed see demand for legal services increase. Well, Ron, there was a lot of anxiety.
Tom, this is Dean Reuter. If I could just break in, I've got to get
Absolutely.
This magic code word. I'm sorry to interrupt the flow here. The code word for purposes of registering for CLE is coercion. Coercion is the code word. So back to you, Professor Morgan.
Thank you, Dean. Coercion fits nicely. Ron Rotunda, there was a lot of anxiety when the Seventh Circuit was read to say that lawyers have a duty to give their clients business advice. For years, malpractice insurers have told lawyers not to do that, lest they become liable if the business hits hard times. And somebody argues the lawyers didn't know what they were talking about. Tell us whether the case really was cause for concern.
Well, I mean, I think there's less there than meets the eye, at least initially. It is true that the ABA Model Rule 2.1, which most states have adopted, says that the lawyer may refer not only to law, but other considerations such as moral, economic, social, and political. And I think really good lawyers do give... And sometimes what you might call business advice. And you can think of some easy cases. You're a tax lawyer talking to your rich client who says that he's going to get married, and they thought it'd be romantic to have the wedding on December 31st at the end of the year. And if you happen to know that they're both income earners, that their liability for income tax will be dropping substantially if they did it at 12:01 a.m., that is on January 1 instead of December 31st, I can see a lawyer volunteering that. In fact, it's probably something that they should do, though I haven't seen a case that says you're liable for malpractice if you do not, because, as you know, we have this this strange rule in the IRS that if two people file jointly, that their tax rates actually go up if they're both income earners. The first dollar of the spouse gets on top of the last dollar of the other spouse. But that's not what the Seventh Circuit said. The plaintiff is a trustee in bankruptcy on behalf of a fund that went belly up. And the fund made loans to the particular fund, the Lancelot Investors Fund. They made loans of a non-existent security to individuals who supposedly use those loans to purchase inventory for other businesses, in this case Costco, though in fact Costco never saw any of it. What happened was that the crook said that we're going to make these funds. You're going to make money by lending money to me, and I'm going to use that to finance some of Costco's inventory. And you should not contact Costco directly. Doing that, he said, would upset my favorable business relations with it. And so the funds gives money to Peters, and Peters puts them in his pocket. Costco never puts a penny into the account. All the money came from Peter's entity. And Gregory Bell, who's the one that was talking to the who got frauded by Costco, he says that Peter's told him that Costco had insisted on paying this into Peter's vehicles, and don't ask Costco about this. The complaint is not that the law firm Kate Muchin should have given business advice. Is that they should have, the complaint of the plaintiff, this is a 12B6 thing, the complaint of the plaintiff is that the law firm should have told the client there's a risk of allowing repayments to be routed through Peters, who drafts and negotiates the contracts necessary to contain the risk, and that the allegation is then that the non-lawyer client did not appreciate the difference between funds from Costco and funds from Peters. The competent transactions lawyer should have told the client the way you're structuring this is going to give you the worst type of security, and you can have a better form of security. If the client, knowing that, decides not to follow that advice, then the lawyer's home free. But if he never tells them that legal advice, that is how to better secure your assets, the lawyer is subject to malpractice liability, and the court then sent it back for a full trial, reversed the lower court. It's legal advice to tell a client that direct verification is Costco plus direct deposits to a lockbox that the other side doesn't control will protect you the most. The second best is the direct deposits in a lockbox that the other party doesn't control. And the worst is relying on papers over which the other party has complete control and you have none. So that's basically the argument. I do not think it requires lawyers to give business advice. I can, that's not what the court said. I can imagine a case where the court tells the lawyer you may be liable if you do not give business advice because the client didn't know, and it was pretty obvious to any reasonable lawyer to have volunteered this. But that's not the Peterson v. Kate Muchin case either. So it is something for lawyers to keep in mind. It is difficult because a lot of a transaction lawyer is involved with a lot of things that aren't necessarily pure law. That is, the lawyer may well be very well informed about the business area, about the lawsuits that the other side is involved in. If the competent lawyer would tell the client, you know, the fellow you're dealing with is, there have been three or four times the SEC has tried to take away his license. The cases have been dropped or he's won, but where there's smoke, there may be fire. If you don't do that, you may have a problem when things go belly up later on, and the client, in this case, the bankruptcy trustee, is looking for a source of funds. The court does say explicitly the lawyer is not a business consultant, but the transaction lawyer must tell the client that different legal forms are available to carry out the client's business, and some of those forms may have a higher risk, a business risk to the clients than other forms, which is also a legal question, that is, some types of security are better than another. And in this case, the way the firm set it up, I chuckle in retrospect, but it's not funny for the people involved. The way they set it up is that the firm is giving money to the people on the other side, who's telling them we're going to make a lot of money when I turn around and sell this to Costco. But the lender never deals with Costco, and is putting the money in a lockbox that's controlled by the borrower. And the borrower, it turns out, signed, forged the names of Costco officials who never heard about these people. And so it was under the complaint that the plaintiffs raised, crying out for the lawyers to do a bit more.
Well, that's very helpful, and I think we have to move along for our final point. Bill Hodes, the ethics of being a judge has been widely discussed over recent years, and the use of social media has been a hot topic as well. It was probably inevitable that lawyer criticism of a judge on social media would attract attention. That happened last year. Do you want to tell us about that case?
Sure. You know, you mentioned that both the ethics of being a judge and the ethics of lawyers attacking or influencing judges. The case that we're going to talk about, which is In Re McCool, it's in the materials. It was a Louisiana Supreme Court last year, 2015, is actually only a lawyer speech case. But it has an interesting tie-in to the recent judicial ethics cases that you mentioned, and I'll end with that little tie-in at the end. Now, it's long been established that litigation is a form of petition for redress of grievances, even when the government is not involved in the case, but it's merely providing the forum. And so the flag of the First Amendment flies, in addition to the American flag, the First Amendment flag flies high over federal and state courthouses and protects the actors in and around litigation. However, while a lawyer is participating in a case, not commenting on TV or something, but is actually participating in a case and is thus really part of the system, literally an officer of the court, significant time and manner restrictions that would not be countenanced for citizens generally have always been permitted by the Supreme Court and as not violative of the First Amendment. The most relevant restrictions, in addition to the rules about confidentiality and privilege and so on, come in several flavors. The key are no ex parte contacts. That's Model Rule 3.5, no pretrial publicity that will have, quote, a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing a proceeding. That's Model Rule 3.6, and no knowingly false attacks on the integrity or qualifications of a judge. That's the analog to libel, but of a judicial officer, that's Rule 8.2. Now, all of these were to some extent involved in the McCool case, although not all of them were discussed in it, and ultimately they were folded into one massive violation of yet another rule, which is engaging in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, which is Rule 8.4D. Here's what happened in the case. It arose in 2006. When Louisiana lawyer Joyce Nanine McCool was assisting a friend in an ugly custody dispute in a Mississippi trial court. McCool wasn't admitted there. She was just helping her friend out. But she was also representing her friend in parallel proceedings in Louisiana. Now, the friend and client in Louisiana, his name was Raven, had accused her ex-husband of sexually abusing their two young daughters and was attempting in Mississippi to terminate his parental rights. At the same time, Raven and her new husband, represented by McCool in Louisiana courts, was trying to have the girls adopted by Raven's new husband. The judge in Mississippi did not rule in Raven's favor, did not terminate his rights, and the judge in Louisiana declined to exercise jurisdiction while the matter was still pending over there, because you can't adopt somebody if it's still somebody else's child. Both matters were appealed in their respective jurisdictions, Mississippi Court of Appeals, Mississippi Supreme Court, Louisiana the same. And while this was going on, McCool used her social media contacts and her legal blog and other kinds of online presences to foment a series of direct contact with the judges and clerks in both states from herself, her clients, from concerned citizens. There was an online petition, and all of these, as the court later found, and hard to deny, were explicitly designed to influence, to put it as politely as possible, the outcome of the cases in Mississippi and in Louisiana. In the course of this, and you really should go back and read the case, just the things that she said online as a lawyer who's actually participating were just absolutely just astonishing that she was able to say those things. In the course of this campaign, McCool repeatedly made false statements about both of the trial judge. The campaign continued when the Louisiana adoption case was on appeal to the Louisiana Supreme Court. Or she's urging people to call the clerk's office in Louisiana to demand that the Supreme Court take this action or that action and to overturn this and to see that the law is obeyed and so on. The Louisiana authorities, not too long after all of this was over, filed disciplinary charges against McCool. And there was really never any chance that she would escape punishment. She was completely unrepentant. She testified over and over again in the disciplinary hearings that as an American citizen, she had every right to do what she had done. One of the bar counsel asked her, well, can you tell me, can you cite any rule that says a lawyer can, you know, instead of appealing, can do this? And her response was, can you cite me a rule that says I can't? I'm an American citizen. So things were destined not to go well for her. So what happened was the disciplinary board recommended a one-year suspension, but the Supreme Court of Louisiana ordered her disbarred instead. Now, without doubt, the court was led to increasing the punishment because of McCool's very unfortunate appearance before the Supreme Court itself, in which she doubled down on everything. She argued her own case. She adamantly refused to admit any wrongdoing. She expressed no remorse. She gave every indication that she would continue to live by her version of the First Amendment, which is nobody else's version of the First Amendment. And here it is, just to conclude, that I think the cases involving proper judicial conduct that Tom Morgan mentioned at the outset, and those are chiefly campaigning for judicial office cases, raising money, making campaign statements concerned about impartiality, the need to disqualify, I think those come into play through the side door. As one of her defenses or one of her interpretations of why this was really a First Amendment case, not a prejudicial to the administration of justice case, McCool had said this in the lower proceedings. She was asked by the disciplinary counsel, do you still think that's appropriate conduct today for an attorney to encourage people to contact a court and ask them to voice their opinions about pending cases? To, yes, I do, she said. Okay, and do you think it's perfectly okay even today for you to encourage that and to solicit that? And McCool's answer, and I think this is what got her disbarred. Yes, they're elected officials. They are responsible. They are responsive and responsible to the people they serve. And if they don't know that people aren't, and they don't know that people aren't concerned, the Supreme Court is a policy court. It responds to things that they believe are important social trends. So, yes, I do believe it's important that the Supreme Court be aware that this is an important issue for people in the community. The number was provided was for the clerk of court. So she was saying, since these are elected judges, it's more appropriate than it otherwise would be for us to amount an overtly political campaign, basically to warn them, rule our way or we're going to vote you out of office next time. And so I think that ties in judicial ethics, which is you're not allowed to listen to that kind of stuff, and her grotesque violations of lawyer ethics by mounting an overt ex parte political campaign in order to influence a court, which is not.
Thanks very much, Bill. It's a frightening note on which to end in some respects, but we are pointing the direction that things may be going in some of these critical areas. That completes our formal presentations. Now the floor is open for questions for the panel. Dean, would you please let us hear the first question?
Sure. We do have to open the floor, actually, to questions in a moment. We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. When you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me remind folks about the registration process here. In order to receive CLE for this teleform, you have to register and pay. To do that, sign in on the CLE sign-in form found on the event page on the Federalist Society's webpage. And finally, email your certificate of attendance and program evaluation to, I'm giving an email address here, cle@fedsoc.org, cle@fedsoc.org, with the correct verification code that I mentioned at the about midway point. Two questions to get us started here. Let's take our first question of the day now.
Good afternoon. Thank you for these discussions. I'd like to revert back to the first set of remarks regarding the new rule dealing with gender issues. There is a trend to, in some universities we see, in which students are allowed to identify how they wish to be identified, and there are upwards of, in some schools, a dozen or more possible gender options. If an individual declines to yield to that transformation of the English language, could that be seen as problematic under the rule?
Ron, that's you.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely a possibility. There was a version before this 8.4 that was only in the comments. It wasn't a black letter rule and was frankly poorly drafted, but not nearly as broad as this one. This has been brought up. That one, I think, took 6 years of debate before the ABA got it through. This one really sliced through in a matter of months. It was very controversial, and the people that favor it have a no-holds-barred, no-prisoners-taken type of mentality. So I think they will see that. Personally, I like to be referred to as my lord, but others may not see it that way. So I think that's an actual problem. You have, some universities now requiring that, and it is an effort. The language is not superstructure. I think it's infrastructure. It both molds and reflects the way we think. And these efforts are all ways to affect the way we think. You know, on gay marriage, my personal view is they should get married and suffer like the rest of us. But people are allowed to disagree on that, even though you have a constitutional right to do something. You have a constitutional right to say the United States is a racist country. But that doesn't mean that others cannot say, I think you're wrong. I think you're immoral for saying that. And I think this is a problem because any word, verbal conduct, this oxymoron, that somebody thinks is illustrates bias allows them to charge this very board, and we don't know what happens after that.
If I can have a brief follow-up.
Could I add just one comment to that? This is Bill Hodes. One of the features of the language that went in that was debated quite a lot is that at the end they added it doesn't only expand the categories of protected classes, It says you're not allowed to harass or discriminate in the practice of law. And it was very much part of the agenda that that was to include not just standing up in court and, you know, making a Nazi salute or something like that, or throwing clients out of your office or, you know, whatever. But it definitely includes the operation of the law firm itself, so that if there's a young associate who, either to use Ron's original example, who doesn't like the bathroom setup, or the caller's example of somebody who doesn't like to be addressed in a certain way at a law firm, you know, retreat, or just during daily business when there are not even any clients around, yes, there is a real possibility that it was certainly meant to apply to that. Whether it would be applied to that's hard to say.
We have time for about one more question. Dean, do we have another one?
We do. Let's move on to our next caller, if we could.
Oh, hi, everyone. It's Dana Brudliner. I actually had a question about the discovery issue and whether that's now playing out in the case law as an ethical issue or just a rules issue. Because, of course, you know, different lawyers are going to disagree about when the discovery is proportional, and that's sometimes going to have to be taken to court. I'm wondering if that's turning out to get litigated or fought about as how dare that lawyer have said that this was proportional discovery. It's crazily excessive. Or if it's just you go to court and you say, hey, I think that was too much discovery, the judge says, okay, we'll cut off this part. You can have the rest.
Well, I think, Dana, it can as it develops, it can be – there's going to be some kind of a symbiotic relationship. They're going to influence each other very much the way disqualification for conflict of interest started out actually as a litigation issue, and then it became an ethical issue, and then it fed back into the disqualification issue. I think that in discovery has not only the whole bunch of rules about what you can and cannot get, it has a built-in, it has its own Rule 11 that says if you make bad faith requests or bad faith refusals, there are separate sanctions on top of Rule 11. And of course, if you violate Rule 11, then that also can become, in the ethics world, it can become a violation of the ethics rule 3.1 for filing frivolous complaints or making filing frivolous court papers. So there is a very close tie-in. I think history has yet to tell us which will become the predominant mode of enforcing, but there is definitely going to be some interrelationship.
Okay. We've reached the time of that we promised as the end of this program. Dean, Ron, Bill, and I extend our thanks to you and to everybody who participated on the call today. I'll turn it back over to you, Dean, and wrap it up for our listeners.
Well, let me thank Professors Hodes, Morgan, and Rotunda for your time and your thoughtful presentations today. Thanks as well to the audience for dialing in and for your questions. Please do check our schedule and monitor your emails for the next scheduled Teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.